Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Matthew Davenport on the show. Matthew is an attorney and the author of two books, the second of which, The Longest Minute, The Great San Francisco Earthquake and Fire of 1906, is our topic for today's conversation. Matthew's first book, First Over There, was a finalist for the 2015 Guggenheim Lehrman Prize in Military History, and was heralded by Pulitzer Prize-winning historian James McPherson as military history at its best. The Longest Minute is a fascinating look at the conditions that led to this terrible fire that destroyed the city of San Francisco in 1906. Matthew has been a contributing writer for the Wall Street Journal Book Review and Salon.com, and is a member of the Authors Guild. He is a native Missourian and a former prosecutor and now practices law in North Carolina, where he lives with his wife and two sons. This was a great conversation where we were able to dig into the earthquake and the fire and a lot more. Let's go meet Matthew Davenport. I just saw the movie Twisters a few nights ago in a packed IMAX theater. It was incredible. And I'm curious your perspective, given what we're about to talk about. Why are we so obsessed with disasters, natural disasters specifically?
That's a good question. And I appreciate your reference to Twisters. Being someone from the Midwest, I grew up in Missouri and went through three pretty bad tornadoes growing up. I don't know. It's the readers, for some reason, tend to like, and especially moviegoers, tend to like disaster because of the human drama involved. And in this case, I'm one of the humans that was drawn to it when I visited San Francisco in 2012 with my wife. And I was drawn to the fact that this many people had been killed and this city was nearly destroyed. It fascinated me, but I realized that's not where the story was. The story was what led up to it and what caused it. And that's where my curiosity went. And in so many cases, like Twisters and things, you have times when you can point to nature and say, this is a natural disaster. And then you've got times when it comes down to city planning, when it's a larger issue of flooding, like with Katrina and hurricanes, for example, or here in Eastern North Carolina, where we deal with it a lot on the coast and poor planning, or in this case, in San Francisco, with city planning that led up to the unnatural disaster that followed the earthquake.
Yeah. And maybe the closest comparison to something in this vein might have been like the flooding during, I'm forgetting the name of the hurricane that flooded Houston, where you just had just development all the way out almost below sea level. And it's just asking for something like this to happen. Would that be the, in your mind, the kind of closest comparison we have, at least in modern times?
I think so, probably. I thought a lot of, and I don't want to harp on it too much, but I thought a lot of Katrina because that was about planning and levees and infrastructure failures and also disaster response as much as San Francisco was.
Do you think working as an attorney prepares you to be a good prose stylist, or is that a different skill than the writing that goes into the legal profession?
No, and I certainly wouldn't call myself a good prose stylist. On the writing side, I think the best way to at least be able to write at all, whether that's well or not, is to read a lot. The more you read, I think the better you sense what is good, a good way to write something, because you can hear the tone and the narrative. As far as being an attorney, that helped me immensely on the research side.
A couple questions about your previous book before we jump into San Francisco and earthquakes. For you, what are some of the best attributes of a well-written military history?
Military history tends to be, for some reason, Hollywood tends to gravitate toward memoirs. And it tends to be the trigger pullers and the grunts' perspective and individual memoirs, like Band of Brothers. And there's value in that. There's a lot of value in adding to the color of combat from the individual soldier's experience or Marine or sailor's experience. The problem you get is you don't get the overall view from the top down. You don't get the command and control logistical issues. My goal in the way I wrote my first book was to write what I called a top-down, bottom-up, where I do a drone view of the battlefield, where I come back to the command and control, say this is what they're planning to do, and then I go down into the trenches, since that was in the Western Front, and say this is what each individual soldier was dealing with up there, and then I back up a little bit and say this is what small level commanders were dealing with, and then I come back, this is what was happening. And so you have to keep both of those in mind in military history. There's too many academic histories, especially, that just say this unit and this battalion and this brigade did this. And there's too many memoirs that say, I fought here and I dealt with these kind of difficulties and I saw my brother next to me, comrade, killed. Neither one gives you a sense of what happened. What was happening at the ground level and what was happening at a command level are both important to understand military history.
And I thought your book did that well. I also read your prior book, and I thought it balanced what I liked about, to take another example from military history, like D-Day. So Bodyguard of Lies is a fantastic book. I'm not sure if you've read it. But then this past year, we had When the Sea Came Alive, which is an oral history of D-Day. And so balancing those two things is an ideal world to live in. So what I really attached to, though, in that previous book was hearing the stories. And I'm curious, in your mind, why do you think Americans are less interested in World War One than World War Two? Is it just that Nazis were better villains? Is that World War One has much more attachment and connection to the 19th century than the 20th century? Is it something else?
It's because of how our media age has evolved from radio to television to film. And the simple fact that World War One was the greatest worldwide conflagration and deadliest war in mankind's history up until what followed 26 years later. And you say just the short space of just more than two decades, something even bigger followed. You never would have seen that. So when Hollywood, especially, but also big nonfiction writers, look backwards at history, they shine a big light on World War II, as well it should be. But the World War I gets lost in the shadows beyond it. And also because the generation that was making films and writing these books, most of the veterans of World War I had died, had passed on. And it felt like something wasn't accomplished there for there to be a II. It is a shame, because without understanding World War I, one cannot understand the world as it existed in 1939 and of course through 1945 to understand World War II.
What was the biggest change in terms of your research process and your writing approach between the two books? Obviously, they're both historical books, but they're operating in very different genres in my mind. What was the difference for you?
The research was much wider spread for the earthquake and fire, because I wasn't just dealing with military history of a single unit. My first book dealt with a single task organization, and I could follow their narratives and into their civilian world and collect them. Here, it was not the 430,000 people or so. That's not graspable. I can't grasp each individual person and where they were. So I had to get vignettes of civilian and then the layers of fire department and the military, Navy, Marines, and Army, and also city leadership, but also the Chinese Historical Society and those narratives that had been shunned for so long. And the layered approach meant I had to go to so many different places to get the sources to complete picture of what was very much an intersectional event, in addition to understanding the science of it, of not just earthquakes and tectonic plates, but also fighting fires, which I didn't know anything about. There were much more things that I had to learn to even begin to write a sentence in this and begin to do research than in a single unit of 2,500 to 3,500 men fighting in a battle.
Yeah, and that was actually going to be my next question, is determining how much science that you wanted to be in this book. How did you come to a conclusion on how you would approach that?
Because I knew what I had read, and I didn't like how the stories had been told. One of the reasons I wrote this book is because I couldn't find a book that told me the story the way I wanted to read it. And that's not the case with a lot of things. There's a lot of events in our history where they've been thoroughly covered and everyone can find a book that was written for them. I wanted something that would tell the story of not just what happened, but why it happened and how it happened, and that would cover the science conversational level and not spend too much time on it, not in a textbook, but also the human experience, but also the city planning and the government and the firefighters and the military, all these things coming together to be able. It's a difficult task because most books that have come before focus on one in lieu of the others. And I didn't want to sideline anything. I really wanted to center stage it all as and keep the narrative going forward.
Let's jump into the meat of the book. We've discussed infrastructure of early San Francisco countless times on this podcast, but I thought it would be helpful to recap for listeners why the city was so precarious beforehand. I think one of the things that I would love to talk about is the rapid nature of development and how that played a role in making the place essentially kindling for a fire.
Sure. And it goes without saying, everyone knows that the population exploded in San Francisco because of the gold rush, but then it continued to explode. And the decade and two decades that followed up through the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad, far beyond the ability for anyone to do any responsible planning. And there was also a profit motive in what was very much a Wild West town. Even after it had grown to 50,000, 100, 150,000 residents, in not either passing, codifying, or enforcing building codes and fire codes, because developers would pay off the governmental officials, in this case, the Board of Supervisors, decade after decade, to make sure that it wasn't enforceable against their tenements, and that any retrofitting based on fires that happened, earthquakes that happened, both of which had happened, as everyone knows, in San Francisco's early days, that they would not be forced to undergo the expense of retrofitting their structures or building new structures based on those because it was too expensive. So that meant the people in poor towns suffered because developers had too much of a leveraged hand in city government. You also had most of the services, which should have been public, especially water, but also transportation, gas, and electricity, in the hands of private monopolies that could make decisions without any oversight, that they weren't going to undergo the expenses of improving the piping, for example, and water delivery system to the poor neighborhoods, and not just in congested neighborhoods, and not just Chinatown, but also south of Market, so that poor, congested neighborhoods were served with inadequate water for even daily needs, much less in the response to a fire.
And what kind of materials were typical buildings made of that made them so flimsy and so flammable?
Wood. And even when you see pictures of San Francisco in 1905 and 6 prior to this disaster, and you see all the brick and stonework, most of those are wood frame structures. And you have wood frame masonry walled structures where all the support and all of the floors are wooden timbers and joists. And most of the homes and tenements and apartment houses and hotels were wooden. It was only recently that they started steel frame construction. Reinforced concrete was a very recent thing. And so most of the fire district was wood or wood frame. And most of the city was wooden. In fact, compared to other cities in the United States, more than 90% wooden. And that was far beyond any other major city. It was literally a crowded tinderbox waiting to burn.
Let's do a counterfactual because I think they're fun from time to time. Let's say the gold rush does not happen. San Francisco develops in a more orderly and more gradual fashion. Do you think we get the devastation that we get from the earthquake and the subsequent fire if it developed in that capacity as opposed to the rapid capacity?
I don't think so. And even if it developed slower in the 1850s and 60s and 70s, let's say, when you do the counterfactual, the Transcontinental Railroad, the calendar on that probably would not have collapsed as it did because you wouldn't have had the gold repository in San Francisco with the incentive to complete the Transcontinental Railroad as quickly. But I think there would have been a lot more time clearly for city planning. I don't know if there would have been the regulations that Baltimore and Chicago and New York City, in response to their own fires and disasters, had put in place, for example. But I certainly think it would not have been as disastrous as it was.
Okay. And what do you think were the lessons that were learned and the lessons that weren't learned from the 1868 earthquake?
There was a narrative that existed prior to this that I ended up not buying into because research led me elsewhere. And I really have to thank Stephen Tobrenner over at Cal for this, because he's an architectural engineer who did his own work on the response to the 1868 Hayward quake, which is they did learn lessons. The architects and engineers in the city at the time said, this is exactly what you need to do to retrofit structures. The problem was the report was buried because there was no profit motive in it. The only motive there was for private businesses like hotels and developers to undergo the high expense of either retrofitting existing structures or building new structures to be earthquake proof was in expensive hotels that could market themselves as earthquake proof. Existing tenements and crowded lodging houses that existed all over the city stayed just as prone to the shaking as before.
Do you think that also explains why, and background here, the Chicago fire of the 1870s changed a lot of different things across the United States. Many cities modernized their fire departments. You had the development of what's called the Chicago School, which is basically don't build buildings that'll burn, and essentially creating building codes that would make it harder for a whole city to go up in flames. Did San Francisco, is it similar situation where there's no profit motive here, so why do we want to modify what we're doing? I just wasn't sure if they made efforts post 1871 to change things in the city to prepare for something like this.
In response to pressure from especially the fire chief, there were efforts, there were things passed in the fire district in response to Chief Sullivan's request. There were new building codes passed. I think 1903 and 4, you saw new building laws passed, and you can go back and see that I researched each of them. The problem was enforcement was in the hands of the mayor's brother, and on his board, he would grant favored developers exceptions. There were quite a few laws that were passed that were not enforced against favored developers. So it didn't much matter because there weren't any teeth if it wasn't being enforced. They also shorthanded the inspectors. There weren't nearly enough, they underfunded the inspection process. So there weren't nearly enough inspectors to go around and make sure people were in compliance as they do today.
Jump into the earthquake itself. And there, within the very brief time that the earth was shaking, there was stages here. There was the initial stage, and then there was an extended period of shaking. Can you talk about those first 60 seconds and what that actually looked like? Because I lived in San Francisco for 5 years and at one point lived in a building on the 10th floor and got to experience what an earthquake feels like. But for a lot of people that are not from California, that are maybe listening, I don't know if they'll have perspective exactly what that's or how that was described.
The thing about this earthquake, and it's surprising when I talk to other natives of California or the West Coast about this, that it's still the strongest recorded earthquake since we've had recorded earthquakes in California's history, since before California became a state. And this was a 7.9, it's estimated on moment magnitude. People still talk about Richter, but that's an antiquated scale now. They didn't even have Richter then. But it's estimated about a 7.9, and it lasted around a minute to 85 seconds or so. And so the fault, of course, everyone knows San Andreas Fault lies about 2 miles offshore of Ocean Beach, west of the peninsula on which San Francisco sits. And that's where the focus was. That's where it broke, underneath the ocean. So the epicenter above on the ocean was about 2 miles west. And when it broke in a strike slip fault, where the two tectonic plates that have been pushing and pushing against each other like this, finally broke. And when it broke in one place, then it broke north and south. And it just kept going and going. So shock waves are sent out. First primary waves and the secondary waves. The primary waves like this, and then the secondary waves of shear force movement. And those are the destructive ones. And they move at such rapid pace, 3 to 5 miles per second, so that you start to hear it, the enormous sound. What I found interesting was most of the eyewitnesses said the sound was what woke them. the sound of it coming. They said it was like, I remember one guy saying it was like a bunch of violinists playing off key. I've never heard a description like that, that it was so loud and jarring. And it went on for a minute and it continued as the fault broke north and south. New shockwaves are propagated from each place that it's breaking. And it's now coming from two different angles into San Francisco, and it continues and continues. I cannot imagine anyone who's been through any strength earthquake from maybe a 4.5 to 5 up knows how disarming it is to be there just a few seconds. 1989, for example, was 15 seconds. This was a minute, a full minute of 7.9, 30 times the strength of 1989. It's difficult to imagine. That's why I spent a whole chapter following it through the city and using eyewitness accounts to describe it.
And there's been 7.8, 7.9 earthquakes just last year. Turkey and Syria had that 7.8 magnitude earthquake. And mm-hmm. given the kind of what buildings are manufactured with in those places, it's similar in a lot of ways. Like I think there's just even some modern lessons to be learned from this about the importance. What happened immediately after the shaking stopped?
It actually would have happened during the shaking. A lot of fires began. And there's one of the myths that I wasn't aiming to bust, but I did, is there's a thought that it was gas leaks and tipped candles and things like that, and fires coming out from stoves and people cooking on broken chimneys that started all these 50 plus fires that ended up spreading. There were actually probably hundreds, maybe even thousands of small fires that began that were put out immediately because people were in their residences to put them out. The ones that spread, that became a problem and consumed neighborhoods and whole districts and eventually the city, were the ones in unoccupied commercial space. And of course, we were on steam power then, so there were a lot of fires burning in steam engines, in factories and foundries. The most common igniter of fires in unoccupied commercial spaces was in drugstores. I had no idea, but there's volatile chemicals that were stored in glass jars on shelves in these drugstores then. A lot of things we would not sell today or that are illegal. And some of them are oxidizers. Some of them are volatile when exposed to heat. Some of them create oxygen when exposed. Some of them, when mixed with other chemicals, can cause ignition. And these places started blazing up and went off like fireworks and artillery, people describe. A dozen of these fires, two of which were so devastating they destroyed entire districts, started in pharmacies, in drugstores. So unoccupied commercial spaces were the biggest instigator. There's only one case of probably a broken chimney causing a fire that spread to destroy a district, and that was the Hayes Valley fire that happened later in the morning.
What was it about the materials, though, about electrical lines and gas lines that made them so easily broken?
They were made with cast iron that was brittle. They'd already been told there was better quality piping and iron that could be used and steel in some cases that could have been used. But most of this dated back to the 1870s and 1880s, most of the water pipes and the gas lines. They had not been updated, as we said, and they were brittle. And so they were running through soft soil. Anyone in the Bay Area knows that San Francisco's fresh water comes from elsewhere. It used to come from down peninsula. So all these pipes that would go up the peninsula ran through soft soil. And when the shaking occurred, and especially the shear movements, it broke these transmission mains that brought all the fresh water into the city, so that the supplies were cut off in most places and only the reservoirs in the city still had water. And most of them had transmission mains and street mains that broke from the movement in the soft soil.
I've seen it discussed in many places, your book but many other places that have monographs I've read about the fire and the earthquake. How big of an impact do you think the fatal injury to Chief Sullivan had on the fire? And do you think, because there's this kind of idea that I've read quite a bit, that his leadership would have mitigated some of the effects of the fire. But I'm skeptical that the leadership advantage of a single fire chief would be enough to make a dent in something that was just an out of control conflagration.
I'm skeptical as well. And I say it in better words in my book, that Chief Sullivan's, the greatest tribute to his leadership is the fact that the fire department worked as efficiently as it did without communication and without, in many places, without water over those 3 days and nights to extinguish the fire without his leadership. Had he been there, I don't think he could have done anything that Shaughnessy and Doherty, the assistant chief and chief second assistant chief, did, the acting chiefs of the fire department in the eastern and western city, because he would have faced the same communication breakdown that they did. Each fire company was acting independently. They were having to send runners, just like on a battlefield in the Civil War or World War One, back and forth from the unit to try to coordinate. It was very difficult to have a department-wide coordination. So it was, the fights were small battles, small unit battles, if you will, to use military terms, out on the front of each of these fires that they were having to improvise and adapt and overcome. And that's one of the lessons, one of the other myths about this fire. People say it burned itself out, it ran out of city to burn. That is not true. The fire department, with the help of the Navy, of course, extinguished the fire. The fire would have kept going had they not worked the way they did.
Yeah. And can you give people a pre and post picture of what was San Francisco look? What did it look like when that last ember was put out?
Really, it was dystopian. It was an apocalyptic ash heap of rubble after it was extinguished. This was the largest city. It's still tough to, when I discovered it and learned it, I had to tell myself a few times over that the crown jewel of the Western United States was not Los Angeles. It was not all these other cities. We think now of San Diego and Los Angeles and Phoenix and Denver and all these great cities out west. San Francisco was the largest city west of the Mississippi, west of St. Louis. And afterwards, it was almost entirely destroyed. And the fact that the heart of the city, the financial district, the downtown, most of the residential areas, when you look at it on a map now, you say, well, that was about 5 square miles of a much larger city. No, that was the heart of the city. All 50 of its banks were destroyed. It devastated. And it's the last time, it's the only time in American history that a major American city was so entirely destroyed.
Yeah. A lot of the after effects, rebuilding, reconstruction efforts are probably the most interesting parts for me personally, just to see what people do after disaster. Do you think the use of debris to build out the coastlines of the Bay Area is the biggest impact in terms of the long-term history of the fire and its impact on the Bay Area? The actual use to create more landfill to expand the city and the coastline?
You mean prior to 1906, the way they expanded the cities?
Well, just what they did afterwards with a lot of the debris to continue to expand the coastline.
There was another thing that I tried to dispel in the book some, and I'd also learned this from conversations and building on the research of Stephen Tobrenner, that in going back and looking at articles and the plans of the recovery and rebuilding at the time, that the debris was mostly dumped out into the bay. That there was and still is this thought that the Marina District was built by debris from 1906, but it wasn't. It was actually built in 1914 and 15 for, of course, the Panama Pacific Exposition in 1915. The city's shoreline was, the debris, most of it was dumped out into the bay after this. Now, one of the problems that they had following it was they still had the soft fill land that existed prior, that had been when they leveled a lot of the hills and dunes early in the city's history. They made this soft fill land, especially south of Market and over by Mission Bay and Mission Cove and over on the east shore, east of Montgomery Street. And that's still the case today. Anywhere from Montgomery to the Embarcadero is fill land. And most things south of Market, east of maybe 3rd Street, is fill land. And now we've learned, just now with the Millennium Tower, we see what happens when you don't build right on fill land. It's still an ongoing lesson that piles are needed or floating foundation structures that are needed. And the city's done that for the most part. I've told people that are visiting San Francisco, they say, I'm scared of an earthquake. I say, you're safer up in the Salesforce Tower during an earthquake than you are down on the street. That it, the way they build earthquake-proof buildings now, engineers, I marvel at it.
Yeah, it's incredible. I actually had a great podcast episode a while ago with someone, and I'm gonna have to cut this because I'm forgetting his name, but he was employed by the city to go dig up ships that were underneath these skyscrapers they were intending to build. And he described digging up one of them on September 11th. He was down in the hole, and the story is fascinating, but essentially there's just this whole world underneath the financial district in San Francisco that's just hidden to your eyes, but there's ships. And he described one time he uncovered a ship and just the smell of smoke erupting from the ship as they unearthed it. It's incredible. It's incredible what's beneath the surface in San Francisco.
It is. And it's because most of the streets, the east-west streets, from Market Street down to Howard and up California Street and Sacramento and those, most of those were piers that went way out into the shallow waters of the bay. And they would bring in ships and sell them as property. And people would build their businesses or homes in the ships or vessels or passenger. And eventually they paved over them and crushed them down and paved over them. So yeah, there's maps online of where the ships are. And the subterranean history of San Francisco is very fascinating.
Yeah. One group that experienced displacement from this was a lot of the residents of Chinatown in San Francisco, which was devastated by this disaster. There's some things that I've read online in various articles that it said that it went from a population of almost 15,000 Chinese immigrants in Chinatown to maybe just over 400. What's your understanding of what happened? And did a lot of these people repatriate, or did they? I read that a lot of them had migrated to Oakland and that became a new home base. And what's your understanding of that particular history?
Yeah, they probably had, including the unlisted residents, because it wasn't yet farming season and many were, so Chinatown's population was a lot higher than during farming season. My understanding is the population was at least 30,000 in those, what was 16 square blocks. They were pushed out of, first of all, the fire pushed everyone out, but they were pushed out early by soldiers. Of course, soldiers were sent in to protect property from looting, but not Chinatown property, not South Market property. The Chinatown property, a lot of the soldiers did the looting. They were sent to protect rich people's homes, Nob Hill, Russian Hill. Of course, as many people know, the Chinese Americans in San Francisco were the most discriminated against demographic in the city at the time of the fire and before then. And they had to have their birth certificate to stay in the United States. That birth certificate was their lifeline to stay with their family. And if they were caught outside of Chinatown's boundaries without it, they could be detained and deported. So I tell the story in the book of one individual, but many of them returned at risk of life and limb to get their birth certificates. And then they're displaced. They're sent out. Either they make it to Oakland, where thankfully the Oakland Chinatown took them in and many gracious individuals took them in. But the other ones that stayed in San Francisco were pushed out into a camp and pushed into another segregated camp and pushed out where the white residents did not have to see them and white refugees would not have to deal with them. And the city leaders, some of them, like former Mayor Phelan and Abe Roof and Mayor Schmidt, one of the new Chinatown pushed down the peninsula out of the city, out of view. But ironically, it was the white property owners in Chinatown, the Chinese residents organized, and I talk about some of them, over in Oakland, continued their newspaper for the displaced residents to spread the news and to try to mobilize to get attorneys with the white landlords that own their property. They had an interest in keeping them there because they paid such high rent and because they made so much money through tourism that they convinced, it was the money, that they convinced city leaders to let them stay in Chinatown. And they fought their way back into the heart of the city where they were and where they still are. It was a battle, and they did it in a very cunning way to stay where they were and where they still are today.
Before we talk about broader lessons from this particular disaster, what role did the Panama Pacific Exposition have on how rebuilding and reconstruction was done? Obviously, when you're inviting the world to your house and your house recently burned down, that requires a lot of quick movement. But it was, because it was in 1915, correct? So it was about 9 years after the fire. How did it shape the redevelopment in the city?
The 1915 specifically, the Panama Pacific did not specifically reshape it from the beginning of rebuilding. It was the showcase for the rebuilt city. And April 21st, when the fires were put out, 1906 on, starting then, as the city knows it's going to rebuild and they're determined to rebuild, they know that out there is going to be a showcase. They want there to be a showcase, and they want to rebuild as quickly as possible. And everyone had the one-year mark as the first goal of how much can we get done by 1 year. And so speed was, unfortunately, at that time, speed was the most important factor. And a lot of safety got sidelined during that time. It has since been a lot of retrofitting and a lot more expense. But within 2 years, the majority of the city was rebuilt. The great photographs of the city has returned, and it's the two-year anniversary. If you look at newspapers, you'll see in the Chronicle, the Call, the Examiner at the Times, as you follow them, that 1907 and then especially 1908, that the city's been almost entirely rebuilt, and now they're trying to push to have some international recognition. So 1915 ended up following, and that was the showcase for San Francisco is back.
Yeah. Let's talk about some broader lessons here. It's a nerdy term. I enjoy using it. I think a lot of books are contributing to a conversation. In the history discipline, we call it historiography. So what is your book contributing to the conversation, both about the specific event, but about disasters in cities? What are you adding to that conversation through this book?
I went to this book not knowing anything about this disaster and not knowing much about the history of San Francisco or California in general. And I think that helped me because I was able to come at it blindly and start with primary sources. So I didn't come in with any preconceived notions or bias. I shunned secondary published sources and said, I want to focus on what happened from the ground level up and build this as it was then. And I ended up discovering a lot of things about the failures of city planning and the motives behind it that help in the history in understanding and dispelling some of the myths that were out there about deaths, about what caused the fires, about why the fire spread, or the role of the fire department. In the broader lesson for other cities, you mentioned it earlier, you look around the world. What happened in Turkey and Syria with the earthquakes last year, it's not natural for an earthquake to cause 100,000 deaths. We can't grasp that kind of loss. We're talking about San Francisco now, 118 years later, and it was 3,000 people estimated. They're dealing with six figures, and that's not natural. And that is because they made the same mistakes. They're in crumbling infrastructure, and they have people packed into tenements that are waiting to their collapsible death traps. And that's what San Francisco was in 1906. But thankfully, San Francisco learned that lesson. California and Oregon and Washington know the structural retrofitting, and they've undergone the expenses, and tens of thousands of emergency management professionals have worked for decades to make sure another 1906 will never happen on our West Coast. The problem is the lesson's not all around the world. I hope, however small or large an audience my book has, that some people will take note and say there is a way to plan better to make sure that natural disasters stay just that, natural. That you don't have unnatural devastation of 3 days of fire and 3,000 deaths.
Yeah, I think with earthquakes, the lesson has been learned. But I just a few months ago had Catherine Blunt on to talk about her book, California Burning, about PG&E's bankruptcy and the fires, the campfire, various things. The lesson's manifesting in different ways. And that was the themes, obviously, throughout your book that California keeps re-experiencing, which is overdevelopment, underinvestment, disasters, and then the cycle starts again. It's a California story.
And that's the problem with it. It is a California story. It's a story across America, but it's particularly punctuated there because of so much the collision of climate change and ecological and geological issues with California. But it's what I call reactive planning. And this idea that we could be proactive, it takes a lot of investment, as you say, because we could learn the lessons from Asia and Japan when they experienced earthquakes and started this retrofitting that we're following now decades later, that it is proactive planning can prevent a lot of devastation, property damage, and death.
We always close these podcasts in the same place with book recommendations. What are a few books you'd like to recommend to listeners?
I've gone backwards in my reading lately because I've become such a fan of the Bay Area and California, and I wanted to study more about it. So I've gotten into Joan Didion, which I had really never read much of her stuff, I'm ashamed to say, before this. And so I just finished my actual second read through of Slouching Toward Bethlehem. Mm-hmm. And I very much enjoyed it. And the White Album also. I really liked her perspective on California, especially that one might sit in Ernie's in San Francisco and think you're 5 miles from the East Coast, but most of California is not in Ernie's. Most of California is not 5 miles from the East Coast by flight. You have to get out and explore the state. And she talks about driving 99 between Sacramento. And it's really interesting because it piques your intellectual curiosity to explore a state that has so much to offer, as all our states do. The corners, the hidden corners of such a beautiful state like California. So I really loved her writing. I loved what it made me think about and piqued in my imagination, and also how it desanitized, or I would say desanitized, a lot of the history around the Summer of Love and made it more real and got into the grit and grain. So I'd recommend it, even though they're old books.
No, that's fine. This summer I'm piecing through a biography of Susan Sontag and reading a lot of her essays and experiencing a lot of the books and movies she's referencing. I've neither seen and probably never will, but it's interesting to watch how her mind works. And I enjoy dipping into that. Last question. What are you working on next?
That's a good question. I have one of the things that I've thought about for a long time, speaking of infrastructure, is the way the interstate highways changed the shape of America and really divided a lot of cities and destroyed a lot of communities. But how, going backwards, this really started with the CCC, that the Civilian Conservation Corps that created so many of our national parks and roads, Blue Ridge Parkway in North Carolina, but so many projects across the country. Then in the next 20 years, 25 years from that, we have an interstate highway system, the largest federal work project. And my grandfather worked for the CCC and up in the Pacific Northwest. And I was always fascinated that this was an army of civilian workers that built so many things we appreciate today, and how the interstate highway system then under Eisenhower follows to create so much more and connect us in a totally different way, and some in negative ways, because we went all in on vehicles and not trains. It's so different from Europe. So I have an idea about that, maybe the dividing highways type concept, but that's where my mind has been. There's just such a massive thing to consider.
Yeah. I love books that take something that's a given, like infrastructure, and help you to understand what it means. So I would look forward to reading that if you chose to write something. Again, the book is The Longest Minute, The Great San Francisco Earthquake and Fire of 1906. Matthew, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time. Thank you.